Hello, everyone, and welcome to Teach Me Teacher, a podcast for educators where we, the teachers, become students ourselves. I'm your host, Jacob Chastain, and today I'm sitting with possibly the most named person on the podcast, Donalyn Miller. She completely changed the way I taught, and it's my privilege to bring her to you today. So Donalyn, how are we doing today?
Thank you, Jacob, for inviting me to be here. I'm so excited. It's nice. You're just my neighbor. You're just down the road.
Yeah. Well, when I got the Book Whisperer originally, you know, you look at the about the author, and you were teaching the same standards I am. You know, you were interacting with relatively the same demographics I was. Uh-huh. And I was like, oh, that just sold the book even more. But it's incredible how close we are.
Yep.
Like I said in the little intro, I mention you all the time, specifically when we're talking about English classes and reading, because you, your book, The Book Whisperer and Reading in the Wild, they changed the way a lot of the teachers at our school taught reading stuff. Some of us took more of what you used, and some of us took a little bit other things. But I know as a sixth grade unit, we were all in, you know, Book Whisperer style, writing, Reading in the Wild. But before we get into all the good stuff we're going to get into, I just want, for people who do not know who you are, what's your elevator pitch that you would give someone so they know about you and all the things you do?
Okay, well, I'm a Texas educator. If my accent didn't make that clear, just keep listening to the podcast. Live in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, as Jacob does too, yes. In the Metroplex, a little closer to Fort Worth, actually. I've taught fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade. Student taught in a seventh grade classroom, decided I didn't want to do that. They scared me.
Something about seventh grade.
Student taught third grade, kind of had the same vibe for different reasons. So I think upper elementary, middle school. I've taught language arts and social studies in Keller ISD and Northwest ISD, which are some big school districts up here. And I really started writing about my classroom because I was in the National Writing Project, and I had joined the Writing Project as part of my grad school requirements. I'll be honest, I joined the Writing Project for two reasons. The writing team, I needed help because they were asking me to be on the district writing team in Keller. I didn't feel effective as a writing teacher. And also because it was free. If you qualified for it, you got 6 paid hours of grad school. And that kind of sounded good to me. And so I came out of that transformed and understanding the importance of teachers writing about their classrooms as a way of improving our own teaching. You know, and I would say that if nothing else, if I had never become a published writer, I think being able to write about my own classroom, to document what's going on there, to look at patterns over time, you know, looking at events over time to try to see patterns emerge in my own teaching is probably one of the most powerful things that came out of that. So after that, I started doing some blogging. I was invited by some publishers to write a book. I said no. I remember my husband and I driving, a publisher flew out to take my husband and I to dinner at the Adolphus Hotel, which Jacob might recognize. And I'll tell you, my husband's in healthcare administration. I'm a teacher. We don't eat at the Adolphus Hotel. And I remember driving over there for that dinner, and I told my husband, I said, I think I'm going to tell them no, that I can't write a book. I'm teaching all the time. And he said, tell him after dinner. Because he wanted his nice Adolphus dinner.
Nice.
But I did wind up saying yes to them. I wrote the Book Whisperer, honestly, thinking my mother would get a lovely keepsake.
Sure.
You know, and what I did know, though, was that a lot of the things that I was doing in my classroom that engaged kids with reading, I felt good about them, but it was difficult to explain exactly in a procedural way why it worked. So the act of kid watching and self-reflection, which I think are a teacher's two best skills, kid watching and self-reflection.
Mm-hmm.
I think that aspect of kid watching and self-reflection that I went through in the process of writing the Book Whisperer made that meaningful to me, even if no one had ever read it. Now, I'm excited people have read it, and it's been translated into 5 languages. I get invited to go to all sorts of great places and meet with educators and librarians and parents, and that's joyful. But I also know that just the act of writing about my own classroom improved my teaching. That's not at all an elevator speech. But
no, you're good. Well, you hit on a couple really fascinating things.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole writing about your experience,
mm-hmm.
When did you feel comfortable doing that? Was it natural to you to start that process, or was there a period where you were like, do I really want to write about this?
I'll let you know when I finally feel comfortable about it.
Nice.
I think part of it is, you know, you have to be authentic to the kids that you're teaching in the classroom. I couldn't just walk into the classroom on any given day and say, hey, kids, I'm writing this book and I'm really stuck on this part. So why don't y'all help me and tell me why this works? You know, I can, because it's not about that. I'm there to be their teacher, right? Mm-hmm. But I think what it did do was, as I said, in totality, I could see that my students were reading more, but to be able to explain that to another teacher in a way that took it beyond the walls of my own classroom and extrapolated it into practices that a lot of us could adopt, I think I focused in more on individual conversations with children, on individual activities within the classroom. And if I hadn't been writing about it in a way where I had to describe it, I don't think that would have emerged. I don't know. It's still, you have to honor the children when you're writing about the children, you know, and to me, The Book Whisperer is as much a memoir of that school year and the children that I taught that year than it is anything about my teaching practice. And so I remember struggling with the structure of that book and really trying to figure out how to lay it out. And I could have laid it out around components of independent reading, which the book I'm writing right now is what I'm doing. But that book really evolved into the story of a school year. So it very much started out, this is what we do at the beginning of the year to lay down a foundation for independent reading to be successful. Now here's how we're sustaining and maintaining it. Now how are we kind of trying to launch kids back out into the summer where we hope they're reading and where they'll maintain an orientation towards literacy. And so when I go back and look at that book, I know, you know, I can see all the instructional components, but I really just revisit all of those children, because they're grown now, and some of them are teachers. I think sometimes people go into writing about their classrooms because they want it to be published, and they don't recognize or perhaps understand the value to their own teaching is the primary goal. Yeah. Honoring the children would also be a primary goal. And that what happens to it after that isn't what can be the pressing concern. It has to be about... teachers do so many wonderful things in the classroom on a regular basis in our interactions with kids. If we're not writing those down, we lose a lot of them. I mean, we wind up with cocktail party stories about some of the kids we've taught if we don't write it down.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you kind of compare it to a memoir, because it does read differently than a, you know, a professional development book. There's not... It's not, this is my method, and here's how I got all of these pieces. It really is like you're almost telling these stories, and then it kind of builds off of things. But as the chapters change, like the way I remember sitting there, I had my laptop open and The Book Whisperer open when I was reading through it, and I was just taking notes, like every page or so. I was like, oh, that's a nugget of truth there. But it's the same, the things I was writing weren't step-by-step processes. It was more of a, if I was in your classroom watching you, right? And I think that's why it's probably connected to people across the states and other countries and things, is the way you write about it simulates the feeling of when you actually go watch a teacher in a classroom, right? Except we get to be inside your head a little bit.
Well, you know, when I was a new teacher, I taught like everybody else taught, because, you know, you're in survival mode and you need your department colleagues, and everybody was assigning book reports and everybody was assigning reading logs and everybody was assigning dioramas and everybody was doing whole class novel units. And so I did all those things too, because those were the models that I had. And even though I had taken a theory class or two reading methods courses in my program, my teacher education program, I didn't see very many classrooms that actually look like some of the instructional methods, including reading and writing workshop that I'd seen. But I did talk about this in The Book Whisperer a little bit. I realized, being self-reflective and watching my kids, that they hated it. They absolutely hated it. And kids would come up to me and say, well, now that I'm done with my packet, can I read my library book? And I started to think, wait a minute, you know.
Yeah.
Here's the... Which one of these is the child's real reading life that matters to them? This packet that I've assigned, or this library book they want to get to for their when you are done activity. And I started to think about my own journey as a reader, you know, and how as a kid, I went to LD Bell High School right up the road, and I had great English teachers there. But I remember reading James Michener's Hawaii out of my desk during our Scarlet Letter unit that we were doing in junior English, because I had finished the book in like a week and a half, you know, and reading it slowly and carefully. And we were going to talk about it for the next 6 weeks. And so my teacher let me read out of my desk, but I thought, how many kids have that split personality, what I call that underground reading life? They've got a reading life at home or outside of school that matters to them, a reading life at school that's about doing activities, checking boxes, finishing packets, you know. And then there are also kids that was all the reading life they had, what it looked like at school, because they didn't have a personally meaningful reading life at home. So I started studying that, you know, and I had a really great colleague down in fifth grade, Susie Kelly. She let me do research for her in her classroom for Reading in the Wild, and talking to her. So she turned me on to people like Faunus and Pennell and Nancy Atwell and Lucy Calkins, and I started reading their books. And, overhaul my classroom completely as a result of all of those things, which, you know, that could be any of us on any random Tuesday, right? Yeah, right. Like, I just need to come in and change everything, starting with the seating chart, right? Because that's somehow magical. But I started trying some things. So really just started implementing a lot of things from Faunus and Pennell, from their book Guiding Readers and Writers, Nancy Atwell, of course, which if people would just read Nancy Atwell's in the middle, the rest of us would not matter. The rest of us who are writing about these things were just variations on Nancy Atwell in some ways, and really trying to observe what was working with my kids. So that's how that all started. But I really started also understanding that reading is a skill, like many other skills. The way you improve a skill is through practice. And that I was doing a lot of teaching about reading, but how much real practice were my students getting to do it? Mm-hmm. And I would watch them check out books in the library they couldn't read. I would watch them not reading on the weekends, over the holidays, or in the summer. I would watch them, you know, reading in a rut, you know, reading the same kind of books over and over again, not really challenged, because nobody was really talking to them about their reading lives. We were talking about their reading assignments. And I came to understand that if they had more positive orientations toward reading in general, that would improve their academics. And the research supports that. You know, there's a huge body of research to show that Stephen Krashen's work on that he's done looking at study after study that show reading volume is the path to reading achievement. The more we read, the higher we score on standardized tests of reading, which makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, no one would think if you read less, you would score higher on standardized tests of reading. So we have that body of research from Dr. Krashen and all the studies that he looked at. We have a body of research to show that choice is a motivating factor. When we give kids choice in what they read, it increases their reading motivation, it increases their interest, which all increases their comprehension. Another way that I look at it is practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. And so if we really want students to capitalize on all the great reading instruction that we're giving them, then they need opportunities to practice what they're learning within the context of real reading events. You know, Carol Jago, who's former president of National Council of Teachers of English, she says books teach you how to read them. And that's just stuck in my brain. You know, we can introduce literary elements, teach kids comprehension strategies, have conversations with them about the shared text that we're using in the classroom. But if they don't then extend any of that terminology or skill into their own reading, they're not internalizing them. That's why, you know, sometimes when I hear people talk about independent reading, they say they can't give up the time. And then I think, well, you're just going to be reteaching these things 3 and 4 times this year then, because you know, kids are not going to get it. And 3 months from now, you'll be saying, everybody remember when we had that conversation about foreshadowing, and you're going to hear crickets. So
that's such a good point. It's ridiculous.
You know, so do I want to plan this foreshadowing lesson, just go ahead and decide out of the gate I'm teaching it 3 times this year?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I want to think about how I can maximize my instruction? I'm not saying we only teach things once and we're done, because that's utopia where no teacher has ever been. But I'm just saying that more often than not, kids will take those skills and transfer them if they are given any opportunity to do it. Also, we know attitude's a big factor in our educational achievement, and children who don't have much practice in reading don't have great attitudes about reading,
mm-hmm.
Which just feeds negative reading identities and their perception that they can't do it.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, so many things in that. One of the things that you hit on, which is pretty fascinating, is this idea that if we try to teach something and the only interaction they have with it is the lesson and the assignment, which could be, you know, a passage with multiple choice questions, mm-hmm. or a passage with an opening question, or mm-hmm. maybe a little bit longer of a passage if you're real kooky, right?
Yeah.
we expect them to somehow internalize this really complicated skill, right? It's not a reading is it's a deeper skill than a step-by-step process. In fact, I would say that I would argue that it's probably that's not even you can't even really break it down into a step-by-step process because there's certain things that come in certain ways to certain people,
mm-hmm.
right? Some students that I had this year, for instance, were really comfortable reading nonfiction. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, the way nonfiction was written really connected to their brain.
Mm-hmm.
But the emotional stability that it takes with fiction or to understand those things and how plots sometimes, they can leave you confused for a little bit. So as a reader, you have to be like, okay, this is the part where like I'm kind of supposed to be confused.
Mm-hmm.
That might bother a certain type of reader.
Well, it would bother an inexperienced reader for sure. Yeah. You know, you think about our kids that we have that abandon books. You know, our serial abandoners, mm-hmm. the kids who ditch a book every time they pick one out.
Yeah.
And I have learned to look at when in the book are they abandoning it? Because I found that a child who's abandoning a book in the first chapter needs support in book selection skills,
mm-hmm.
because that was just a bad book choice. They either can't read it or it's not engaging to them. Maybe they need to give it a little more time. You know, those are some conversations I would have over here with a child who's always abandoning a book, page 12, page 30. But then there's another group of kids that are abandoning books, page 75, page 130. And you're thinking, they've already made maybe a couple of days at least investment in this book, so mm-hmm. why are they dealing themselves out? And it's exactly what you were talking about. They're confused, or they don't understand narrative grammar. You know, they don't understand that a fiction book is a lot like a play, right? Like you have the first act, a lot of exposition going on, introducing character, setting and plot, setting up the conflict, mood, tone, a lot of stuff going on for a reader to pay attention to. And then in the middle of a book, it's that second act kind of complications build part.
Yeah.
And it gets draggy. It can get draggy. Mm-hmm. And I bet all of us as adults have said, this book better speed up soon or I'm done. And then it does.
Yeah.
Well, kids who don't have a lot of reading experience, they don't understand that third act payoff. The resolution of the conflict, the mm-hmm. climax of the story, because they wind up ditching books 70 pages in, 100 pages in during that draggy spot. And I think it's a lack of experience.
Yeah.
And just how books even go that kind of lead them to that place.
Well, the funny thing is, though, the only way you can teach that is to actually let kids read and experience
yeah.
it and be there and be their support for when it does mm-hmm. happen to certain things. Like one of the conversations I had over and over in my classes this year is a lot of our students are reading YA.
Yeah.
YA is like almost every YA book is first chapter. Something major is happening.
Yeah.
Something huge. You know, it didn't matter what genre.
Yeah.
And then usually after that, it's kind of them dealing with it, and then the problem sort of transforms into something else.
Yeah.
And it was after that big moment that kids started dropping out of stuff. They started, you know, putting down the book or saying, oh, it got boring all of a sudden.
Uh-huh.
And over again, I was having these conversations with them, and I was telling them, I was like, I get bored in my books all the time. I was like, I'm a sucker for epic fantasies.
Yeah.
900-page books.
Oh, yeah.
Every one of those pages is not engaging. They're not.
No.
I'm sorry.
Well, and also, you know, with the first book in a series that's science fiction or fantasy,
yeah.
the readers, because of the world building, the readers often signed up for confusion for the whole first book in a
yeah.
series. You know, you
totally.
Think about any epic fantasy sci-fi trilogy that we like. I like to read those too. Is that first book, you're just trying to figure it out,
mm-hmm.
figure the world out. And for a reader who doesn't have a lot of experience or they're still very much at the concrete level, that's hard reading. That's
yeah.
hard. And boring could be boring, but boring is sometimes code for I don't understand it.
Yeah.
I don't understand what's going on.
That a lot of our So based on our reading levels that we know at our school, and there's a couple ways we look at it. One of the main ways is there's like a, it's kind of like a Lexile test that they end up taking, and the district has us do it. And there's definitely give and take with that, but it's a healthy indicator of, it can kind of point in the right direction.
Yeah.
I don't think teachers should hang their hats on those things. But you know, if you have zero data, it's something to look at.
Yeah.
But by and large, you know, if we're just using that to measure, a lot of our students, you know, not even close to the sixth grade level. We have some that are really advanced that are like in the high school level, you know, if you're talking Lexile, and then they get down there to the elementary level, some of them, you know, third grade, fourth grade, and they're trying to read certain books. But I find that it's really not the Lexile level that stops them. It's not their reading level. It's their comprehension of, I guess, what you just called it. What did you call it? You called it narrative grammar?
Uh-huh.
Is that what it
they
was?
They don't understand how stories go.
Yeah, and that, I think that's it's a separate issue. For a teacher looking at this, if they're, you know, trying to see if a book is too hard or if it's really a lack of practice, how is a teacher supposed to decide the difference of what's happening to their students?
Well, if it's too hard, it's always a lack of practice, right?
Sure.
I mean, we could just loop those together in that if they read more, we know their achievement would improve. So it's a cycle that feeds itself. It's not an easy question to answer, but reading level, first off, we know reading level, none of the reading leveling systems that are currently being used in American schools today were originally designed to be applied to children.
Yep.
Every single one of them, Lexile, DRA, Fountas-Pinnell, all meant to be applied to texts to help teachers and librarians evaluate materials for differentiated instruction. So the minute we started using all of those numbers and letters and started applying them to the children, we were corrupting them. Now, the genie's out of the bottle now. Here in Texas, they print the Lexile scores right on the STAR test reports. Publishers have gone crazy printing it on all these books. Parents will come to you with a list from some website they found of books that they think are at their child's brilliant reading level. You know, so teachers are being stuck with it, basically, and using it. I think what we have to do is teach kids, no matter how we feel about leveling, and it is such a polarizing issue, no matter how we feel about leveling, the one thing I think we could all agree on is that leveling is a scaffold. It's temporary. It's meant to come down. I don't see, and I joke about this in my presentations, I don't see adults at Barnes & Noble looking for the blue dot section. I sure don't see them looking for using the five-finger rule to select a book. So no matter how we feel about using leveling right now, when they're fourth graders or seventh graders or sixth graders, we have to recognize that adult readers do not use leveling as a system for determining how to pick a book. So how are we teaching children skills in how to select books the way readers really do? On top of that leveling, recognizing that that leveling should diminish over the course of the school year. So the way we're using leveling in second grade, it should look different in fifth grade. We shouldn't just be using it the same. We also have to look at reading levels not fixed. Psychology Today had a whole article recently, Three Myths About Reading Levels, that talks about how it's situational for a lot of readers. It's text dependent. For a lot of readers.
Meaning like they might be really good in one area. Like they might be really good at reading instructional manuals, right?
They might be really good at reading some kind of nonfiction. They may struggle more with fiction because they have less experience or they're not as motivated to read it. So we've also found that motivation and background knowledge matter just as much when we're matching kids with books. That's why we can match kids with books that are at their Lexile and they can't understand it. And when I say background knowledge, I do mean academic background knowledge, factual information. You know, what do they already know about sharks before they read this article about sharks? What do they already know about World War II before they read this textbook passage? But when I'm thinking about kids and I say background knowledge, I also mean life experience. So, you know, the fact that we assign so many books published for adults to middle schoolers and high schoolers to read ought to give us some pause.
Right.
Because those books are not, very few of them were written for 16-year-olds or 17-year-olds or 15-year-olds. So they don't necessarily have the life experience to understand Jane Austen.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying we shouldn't teach Jane Austen, but we have to recognize that they're not the target audience for those books when they're originally written. And that we are expecting children to have some nuanced understanding of human interactions and life in those books that they don't have. And that they can only learn about in the abstract from what their English teachers tell them about it.
Mm-hmm.
We also have to look at, you know, for kids who are gifted readers, and, you know, gifted readers score 2 years higher than their grade level on standardized tests of reading, special tests for gifted readers. They may have the background knowledge factually. That book may be at their reading level, but they may not have the emotional maturity to access it either. So we have to look at how motivation, background knowledge, and reading level all kind of come together when we're matching kids with books. Also, let's be honest. If we're not that motivated to read it, our comprehension suffers.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah, it's true.
It does. And if we look at our own lives as adult readers, which book are we probably going to retain more of? That book that we self-selected that we wanted to read, or that book we're assigned for the school-wide book study, where we're figuring out our calendar and our phone, how many minimum pages we have to read each day until the book club meeting, right?
Right.
Like every teacher listening to this podcast has been there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying every book we're asked to read is not inspiring or motivational, but some of them aren't.
Yeah.
And we go into those acts of reading with a different orientation because our motivation is a factor.
When I've had these conversations with, you know, my academic coach or just educators in general, you know, at a conference or something like that, and you start talking about, you know, I do independent reading in my classroom. You know, a lot of my, you know, most of the reading they do is self-selected. I do mentor texts, I do things like that. But this year, we were just living in their self-selected things.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the biggest responses I had were, they were like, oh, well, you know, how do you know they're actually doing the reading, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen you've mentioned this complaint, not complaint, but like snarky little thing, because it's really what they're asking is, you know, where's your proof that these kids, you know, you're letting them self-select and you're teaching them the skills to pick books, but how do you know they're actually reading?
Yeah.
So what's your response?
Well, I think that's because in some ways teachers are fearful that kids are going to slide through their classrooms fake reading. And the first thing I would say to all our colleagues out there is that give yourself some credit. Really. You know, I had 130 sixth graders, all right? Do I think all 130 of them could successfully lie to me for an entire school year about whether they were reading or not? Okay, no. So, I'm smarter than that, right?
Sure.
Now, not a chunk of them are reading. And sometimes we hyper-focus on the kids who are not doing it and declare as something a disaster. And sometimes it is helpful to focus on the children that are actually doing it. Now, I'm not saying we should only see that as evidence of our good teaching, but we can check a mental box and go, okay, some of my kids are really doing it. Now, who do I think isn't? And what am I going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
Because especially when you get up to our level, upper elementary, middle school, if kids are fake reading, they learn that skill long before they ever came to you. It's not personal.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean their teachers the previous year didn't know what to do or didn't try anything. It just didn't stick. And also kids come in every year and they want to fill out like how far.
Sure.
Where are the boundaries? What's the expectation? What's the culture in here? Oh, he expects me to read. How long before he knows I'm not really reading? I mean, there are a few kids that will work out that system for themselves or work out that scenario. We really only have two ways of knowing what kids are thinking when they read: what they tell us and what they write down. So I have found that reading response journals and conferring with kids, having regular reading conferences, are the two best accountability pieces I could possibly employ. Because when I ask children to write about what they're reading, and I give them prompts to do it, or guidance, or advice, and they can't write anything because they're not reading, well, there's my proof. You cannot write a one-page reading response entry every week if you're not really reading anything.
Mm-hmm.
And those are graded assignments in my class. The other piece is the conferring piece, is having regular conversations with our kids about what they read. Now, teachers often ask me, well, how am I talking to them about a book if I haven't read it?
Yeah.
And Penny Kittle said one of the brightest things. If you know Penny and her work, Book Love, but Penny at a conference, she said, I think sometimes I'm better about conferring with kids about a book I haven't read. Because, and she was right, and the way she explained it was, you know, if you have read the book, it's really easy for that to veer into kind of a book clubby conversation. Oh,
sure.
We both loved The Lightning Thief. What did you think of the movie? It was awful. I know. And 5 minutes later, you're thinking, okay, did I move this child? Well, we bonded, but did I move this child instructionally down the road?
Right.
Probably not. How do we know if kids went to a birthday party on Saturday? We weren't there.
You ask them questions.
They tell you all about it, and you ask them questions. And, you know, this is the same with reading. You ask enough questions, you're going to figure out whether they've read it or not. And even the child, and there are things to look for. The child who only reads books that have been made into movies. Yeah, okay, that might be a challenge. Mm-hmm. Child who's carrying around the same 300, 400 page book for a month, still reading it. Every time you sit down and talk to them, they haven't made that much progress. I mean, we can see those signs. And they do happen in all of our classrooms. They happen in mine. They happen in yours. Mm-hmm. It's how are we going to turn that around? But I found that, you know, the reading response journals, and there's tons of things online. You could probably spend half your summer just looking at different ways to do those. You can't ABCD your way through that. It's blank pencil and a paper. Tell me what you know. Use evidence from your book to support your opinions. If you're not reading anything, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. I had, by and large, I had the, out of doing this process, you know, mimicking the Book Whisperer and reading in the wild, basically, as much as I could within my constraints of a classroom. The biggest thing I've had issues with was keeping accountability with my students. I conferenced with them and I talked with them, and I could easily sit in a room and say, you know, these are the students who are really doing a lot of the reading. These are the ones who I have to kind of keep an eye on. And then, you know, one or two might be struggling to actually get through the process of reading a book.
Yeah.
But the thing that, you know, I start off with the reading journal, right? And I just printed off the back stuff that you had in Reading in the Wild. Mm-hmm. And I just used those exact copies pretty much. And they even had their genre chart to kind of focus on, okay, you've read, you know, 10 fantasy books. How about we step into mm-hmm. another genre? Mm-hmm. But the thing that ended up happening is by the end of the year, you know, we hadn't really pulled those out. They had done some reading responses on paper that they turned in. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't this accountability conferencing that you really advocate, and almost all the research advocates. That's like the big piece. When administrators, when we talk about independent reading programs, a lot of them just hear us say, yeah, kids are reading, right?
Yeah.
And they don't actually hear, yeah, but we're actually conferencing with them, and there's a art and a science to kind of this. So if you could just talk about, when you say conferencing, when we're talking to our students about books, what does that look like? And I know you had mentioned in a blog somewhere that you really couldn't do a checkbox type of conference. I just want you to kind of briefly talk about that, because I think I'm in the similar situation.
Well, first off, the one thing I want to say, kids fake reading. I just want to say one more thing about that. The goal of having a conference with a child about their independent reading is not to catch them not reading. It's to set goals.
Yeah.
So if we do ever have a child that we suspect is lying to us, well, now we know what our goals are. That's all. You know,
yeah.
I mean, he's fake reading.
He's showing a need.
This is what he needs as a reader, because mm-hmm. there is no commitment to reading. There's no engagement. He's not actually reading anything. So probing his comprehension over and over and finding out he's not reading anything is not helping him.
Sure.
So if we suspect a child is fake reading, then that we know what our goals are. But it also means they have some self-esteem and shame tied up in reading, probably, because why would they lie to us?
Yeah.
It's not because they really think they're going to get away with it. That's every time.
Yeah.
You know, as far as the conferring, I will say that the thing about reading and writing workshop or any instructional methodology that we plan to use in the classroom, sometimes we throw out the pedagogy because we can't get the management pieces to work. We believe in the belief of it, but in the real interactions with live children on a daily basis, some of these things are just difficult to sustain and maintain. There's real kids in the room. We have real curriculum demands. We have assemblies and sports events and photo day and, you know, ozone days and all these other things that affect our teaching on any given day.
Sure.
And so what happens is we have, I think part of it is we see this vision in a book. Of someone who's just magically sliding through all of these things. And we think, well, I can't do that. My kids can't do it. I can't do it. I can't make this. She has 87 minutes. I only have 42. You know, people say that.
Oh, how many times have you been told that, by the way?
Oh, I have 87 minutes in sixth grade. And I go, well, I taught language arts and social studies. I was responsible for all of that.
I know that comes up because I've had people say it to me.
Yeah.
And my classes are short.
Yeah.
So, anyway, sorry.
No, but I know teachers with 42 minutes down in Taylor, Texas, who are making it happen. So, somebody's making it work with 42 minutes. So, you know, let's talk about what those obstacles are that are preventing you from being able to do it, because we can cherry pick people from anywhere and have them match you exactly. So, but I think part of it is we have that vision of what it's supposed to look like. And when we don't attain that vision, we think it's failing or that we can't do it. And if there was any piece of my teaching that I think I would still be working on over and over and over again for my entire career, it would be conferring with kids about their reading and writing, because it's just hard to commit to doing it every single day. You've got to do some sort of record keeping, so, or else you're not making anything long term out of it. And there is that accountability piece. So, I talked about this in Reading in the Wild quite a bit. I think it's important to really reflect on what it is you're trying to get out of those conversations and then put some tools in place that help you make it happen. So I'm not meeting with 5 kids a day. I've never been able to do that on a consistent basis. I tried to turn it into a math problem. I had 35 kids 1 year. No, I had 35 kids in a class. I'm supposed to be pulling small groups and conferring during this 25 minutes that we have for independent reading, or however mm-hmm. long. And I would just, it was terrible. I walked around with my clipboard. Oh, we made eye contact. She's still reading The Lightning Thief. Okay, moving on. And it was terrible. I couldn't get to 7 kids a day. So then I used to celebrate if I quit conferring later in the school year than I had abandoned it the previous year.
Sure.
Like, oh, I made it to Christmas. We are not doing this when I come back. But here's what I do know. That may be our only opportunity one-on-one with the kid to talk to him about reading and writing. And we're talking about 5 minutes every week or two. And that's it. You know, so I don't want to miss that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a relationship builder, if nothing else. And kids want to feel seen. They want to feel like their teachers see them. And too many times in my career, I've had kids walk out past me the last day of school and I've said, I don't really get to know her. How is that possible? She was in my classroom all year long, mm-hmm. and I can't tell you 20 things about her, yeah. you know? And that's not a great place to be as a teacher. So I just really decided that I would skinny down what my focus was in a conference. And then I would try to meet with as many children a day as I possibly could and make it meaningful. So if it's 2 kids a day, then it's 2 kids a day. And there are those days where you meet with 5 kids and you're just celebrating because you need to cling on to that, mm-hmm. right? But I remember thinking, I'm not doing it the way Nancy Atwell does it. I'm not doing that. It occurred to me one day, Nancy was never coming. She was never coming to my classroom. She was never going to fix it. She was never going to help me with my students, and that I needed to figure it out. One thing that really helped me with my conferring quite a bit is I used to have all my conferring forms on like a clipboard, and I would try to file those and make sense of them. I've gone completely paperless, which has helped me a ton. So there's an app called Evernote. A lot of people mm-hmm. use it. It's the one that has the little elephant head as the icon. It's free, which is one of the things I like about it. I don't have to wait for a district to pay for it for me or decide they're not paying for it. And also it's a cloud-based. It's not device dependent. So I could log into a laptop at home or an iPad or my phone and get on it. But what I like about Evernote is it's really just a data collection tool. So you can snip articles off the internet and read them when you're offline. You can record, you can take photographs, you can shoot audio, you can type directly into it. And I just basically made a notebook in Evernote for every single one of my students. And then you can drag them into stacks by grade. So period 1, period 2, period 3. And now I just take my conference form that has my questions on it, my starter questions. I've laminated that, put it on a loose leaf ring behind my desk. And then when I sit down to confer with a child, I take my phone, open up Evernote, find their notebook, and hit record. And then we just talk. And I may look at my reference materials to see if there's some questions I want to make sure I get to with them. But in general, we just have a conversation. I look at the reader's notebooks. I see what they've already documented from the last time I talked to them. What mm-hmm. books have they read? Like you said, looking at their genre graph, like what gaps do I see? Oh, he hasn't read a biography this year. You know, I'm looking for goals. And what I also like about it is, you know, when we're scribing through an entire conversation with a child, writing down notes, number one, the more we write down, the more anxious they become. Because, oh my gosh, he's writing down a lot of things about my reading. I must not be a very good reader. Kids start to want to know what you're writing down. It mm-hmm. starts to bother them, I think, or be a distraction, if nothing else.
That's an interesting point.
And you can't the conversation isn't natural because you can only write so fast compared to how long you could talk. So that act of writing things down added to the time of the conference. So if, instead of it being a 3-minute conversation, it turned into a 5-minute me writing things down. So that was, honestly, moving over to where I was just recording them probably saved me 5 minutes a day where I could get to another kid, you know? Sure. What I like about Evernote is it's emailable. So you could just email things to the RTI specialist. You could email them to parents. I could be in my room in my principal's office talking to him and talk about a kid, and I could just log into Evernote and pull up their documentation. It's also searchable, so I could type in a child's name. It'll pull up every note I've done on them all year. So just that tool gave me some efficiency back. And I also think it made the conferences better because I can go back and listen to those conferences and reflect on my own behaviors too as a teacher. So I can listen to it and go, oh, I talked too much.
Sure.
Or, oh, I led that child right to the question I wanted them to give, the answer I wanted them to give me. I didn't give them a chance to really show me what they knew. You know, so that was helpful too.
When you would conference, did you worry about how much, were you more concerned about your accountability to the student? Basically, you know, I'm, as the teacher, you know, I really want you to read, but I'm gonna hold you accountable to it. Was that more of your goal, or was there also a goal of showing accountability to people that would walk in your room, such as your principal or district admin that would walk in and, you know, look at stuff? Did you worry about that at all, or was it really just about you and the student?
Well, I think as teachers, we should be held accountable for doing meaningful work with our kids in the classroom. So I don't think I ever really put conferring in place for that purpose, you know, to go, okay, well, this helps justify why I'm doing independent reading. Because I had all the research in the world I could drag out on why independent reading needed to be happening. So that wasn't the issue. But I think part of it was the two main goals I really had. One was that relationship building between me as a mentor, reader, and writer, and my apprentices. I mean, if you think about a workshop, that's what a workshop really is. You have a mentor, a more knowing other, who was once an apprentice in the same skill, who is modeling for you how to do it, and believes that you can learn how, and you are their apprentice, you know? So maybe a hokey way of looking at it, but that's pretty much why we call it the workshop model. Sure. Right?
Well, that's a good point, because we don't actually look at the definition of, okay, what's a workshop,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So I'm Paul Revere, right, and so are you. We're silversmiths, and we have a whole bunch of kids in our workshop, and they're all going to be silversmiths too. Mm-hmm. Only our craft is reading and writing. And so that may be my only, you know, if you think about small group instruction and targeted reading interventions, when we start pulling groups of kids together to do any kind of instructional work, we are automatically making compromises because they may have overlapping goals and needs, but they're not all identical. So we start compromising. We'll do group them by reading level when they may not all need the same skills to remediate, right? Yeah. Or we'll group them. These kids all struggle with making predictions. Yeah, but these three also struggle with this, this, and this. So what group are they going in? You know, ideal small group size where no teacher will ever teach is one. So that conference is the best chance we have to truly target instruction for that kid. I'm also looking at that child's individual reading and how can I set goals just for them? Because we have a lot of content goals, a lot of standards, knowledge and skill pieces that apply to all the children in the classroom. But individual children need individual things. And we're being asked to differentiate for kids all the time. And conferring to me is really targeted differentiation for them. So those are my primary goals. The relationship building, the targeted differentiation, moving a child forward as a reader. I have come to understand that a lot of the data recording and things I was being asked to do for RTI, for special ed, that if I can just repurpose some of the tools that I'm using, I can duplicate it. So, for example, I have an observation form about fake reading that's in Reading in the Wild where I just watch children and record and then make a goal. That's gone right into the RTI folders of all my kids that needed it because that shows data collection, it shows teacher reflection, and it shows goal setting for the individual student, which is exactly what RTI is asking us to do. So I think there are ways to take all that conferring records and really turn it into documentation for your RTI binders for your meetings, for your intervention plans.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, it really is.
Because we're doing all that data collection anyway. But mm-hmm. do you ever feel like sometimes that data collection is arbitrary? Like, it sits apart from your instruction in some ways? And that's just, so it's just filling out forms for the sake of filling out the forms.
Yep.
You know, and we're just asked to document. We're not really prescribed, I hope, in a lot of places, specific documentation tools to use. We may have a master checklist, but all of our RTI is data collection, which includes classroom observations, reflecting on our instruction, and setting goals for the children.
So you briefly mentioned like this mentor aspect.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that we did this year, which I'm going to ask your opinion on in a second, was we went to a school who was kind of, they were doing a lot of independent reading things.
Uh-huh.
A little bit different. But that was kind of their goal.
Uh-huh.
One of the things they told us when we went and watched them was, you know, when they're doing their reading, their independent reading time, the teacher should be modeling what that looks like. And so we took that back to here. Mm-hmm. So 15 minutes a day, and this is the hill I died on all year long. I never let up unless it was a test day or unless it was like, you know, something else going on.
Yeah.
But I even told my kids at the beginning of the year, I was like, I'm going to read with you for this 15 minutes a day. We have a 54 minute class. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna read with you these 15 minutes. These are religious minutes in this class. I was like, if my wife is dying, she's gonna have to wait 15 minutes before I pick up my phone. And they're like, oh. And then, you know, once I was in it with them,
mm-hmm.
it was this thing like, oh, you know, Chastain's doing it, so I'm gonna do it too.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, the kids that would struggle, you know, I'd go sit with them and I would just join them, you know, and be, it was like a reading time. But one of the things, and this I think where my conferencing went too, is losing 15 minutes every day from me was I'd made sacrifices doing mm-hmm. that. I had great modeling for them. You know, they watched me pick up books. They saw how often I changed books.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I lost valuable time that I could have been mm-hmm. used conferring or observing mm-hmm. In a lot of ways. I mean, every teacher's always observing, and if you're reading the book, right? But that was a significant amount of time to take away from me. So when you're talking modeling, is it necessary for us to make that big of a commitment, or should we step back and be more of a moving around the room and doing the conferencing during that time? So during their time of reading, what should the teacher be doing?
Well, it has to do with the word modeling, right? Mm-hmm. And we also have to recognize that one of the reasons that independent reading programs have fallen into disfavor in many communities is because of programs like DEAR, where everybody dropped and was supposed to read, and then teachers didn't. They were on their email, or they were grading sure. papers, or the principal was still calling things over the announcements during DEAR time. I mean, you're still running a school. And I think that's where that idea of the teachers reading while the children were also reading was how that got picked up on. I don't know a single study that has ever compared teacher reading, teacher not reading on the engagement and motivation of kids. I don't know of one. Mm-hmm. If one exists, I'm sure one of your listeners will find it for me. But I've read a lot. So
sure.
When we say modeling, I think the most important modeling we can do is an orientation towards a literary lifestyle. So carrying books in our bags, talking about what we're reading. When we go to the library with children, we check out books too. Those are all acts of modeling. When we sit down and have that conversation about The Lightning Thief, you know I've read it too, right? And also, I wouldn't necessarily book talk those books, but children understanding that I read lots of things, including journals that relate to my profession. I read books published for adults. I read magazines. I read blogs. I read a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
That all comes up from our conversations reader to reader in the classroom. So when we're talking about everybody list the things they like to read, I'm going to be honest in my list when I share that, and they're going to be honest in theirs too. It's that transparency that I'm not just telling you to do it. It's also something that I like to do. And here's why I find it meaningful and useful. That's the kind of modeling that kids need. And also the modeling in real reading strategies and real skills, which we're also modeling for them. I do not think that teachers reading every single day of the school year side by side with their students is necessarily the best use of us. Now, I have done that in specific instances, and here's where they are. Beginning of the school year.
Yeah.
I'm not conferring with kids. We're not starting readers' notebooks. We just glued it together yesterday. You know, I am trying to set that ritual and routine of the daily reading time in the classroom. So maybe the first week or so of the year, I am reading right alongside the kids because I'm trying to reinforce. Because it's interesting. If you're sitting at your desk and somebody needs to go see the band director or go to the nurse or pick the reading avoidance behavior that you would pick, they will get up and they will come over to your desk. But if you are sitting in the middle of the classroom next to Bob, who's also at a school desk, and you are reading your book and you are surrounded by all of your kids, they won't. They won't. They won't try it because then they feel like they're interrupting you while you're reading. Yeah. I don't know how else to explain it.
Sure.
I've also, and it's also reinforcing that we're all readers. We all do this. I'm trying to get to know all of you, so I'm going to come sit right with you.
Mm-hmm.
I have picked squeaky kids to sit right next to. You know?
Yeah.
Because you're going to take, you know, pull it while I'm sitting right next to you. You know, and they don't.
Sure.
It's a way of shutting it down. So I have read with my students at the beginning of the school year. I have also, if a class has just lost their routine of falling into the books, everybody respecting each other, and if that's fallen apart in some areas of the classroom, then I might go sit next to that disruption that day or a couple of days just to kind of remind everybody what we're doing. And there are times when I do a run of conferences, let's say, and I've met with my whole class and it's Thursday. I'm probably not starting a new run of conferences on a Thursday, recognizing I'm going to do four or five kids Thursday and Friday, and then Monday I'm going to do the rest of them. Or then I might pull out my book and read. And so often what I will do then is I try to bring books, if I'm reading them at school, that I can hand to a kid.
Yeah.
And they can watch me react to it. Mm-hmm. You know, not that I'm dramatic about it or fake, but, you know, sure. If I'm laughing or I'm going to get a Kleenex or something, that intrigues kids. They get to trust our book recommendations. So if we finish a book and they've seen us read it, they want it. You know, it's just another way of book talking it. So in those three cases, beginning of the year, routine setting, interventions for possible disruptions, and then also, you know, it's a weird time of the week to start a whole run of conferences. Mm-hmm. Then I'll bring my book in and I'll sit and read. But as a daily routine, I don't feel like I can give up the conferring time.